This is Beyond Species, a podcast exploring issues around speciesism and the struggle to dismantle it. Steve, welcome to the episode. In this episode, we hear from Dr. Catherine Oliver. Catherine's studies in vegan geographies have led her to explore how and why people take up veganism, and how for the majority of them, veganism is a politics that is felt, emotionally and physically, and lived and performed. This embodied politics contrasts with the simplistic soundbites of social media influencer activists. We also hear about Catherine's study of Richard Ryder's work and how a group of men, including Tom Reagan and Peter Singer, came to dominate the discourse of animal rights. Catherine also outlines some of the questions she intends to look at within her current area of investigation, the rehoming of chickens, particularly in London, and the complications and possible outcomes around this. So, do you want to start then by telling us or giving us an introduction to yourself and your studies?
Yeah, so I'll start with saying I went vegan in 2013. And so this kind of led into what I do now. And I work at the moment in vegan geographies, animal geographies, which we'll talk about a bit more about through the episode. But I went vegan in 2013. At the time, I was doing my undergraduate degree in geography. And basically, it kind of coincided that we had a new lecturer and I started thinking about veganism and vegan geographies and like the geographies of veganism and started working with this new lecturer who eventually became my PhD supervisor. So I started my PhD in 2015, trying to remember my days, in 2015. And my PhD was on, well, it's largely on vegan geographies, but it was on vegan history. So I was based at the British Library for 8 months in 2016-17, working in Richard Ryder's archive. And then I spent a lot of 2018 interviewing vegans in Britain, so across all of Britain. And then the final part of my PhD was working with, doing multi-species ethnographies with chickens, so ex-laying hens that were rescued. They were rescued at about like 8 weeks old, so it was before they went on to the laying farm. And they were at my parents', and so the last part of my PhD was with these chickens. And I finished my PhD earlier this year. This year's dates are just, they mean nothing to me anymore. In May, I finished my PhD. I'm like, what month is it now? And in July, I started my postdoc position at the University of Cambridge, also working with chickens. I'll be working with chickens in London over the next few years. So my research interests lie in vegan geographies. And so geography or human geography is really interested or attends to like socio-spatial study or the interactions between humans and their environments. Although for me, the interactions are between humans, animals and their environments or multi-species environments. And so animal geographies has gone way back, like over 100 years, kind of studying animals in geography, or the spaces and the geographies of animals. But for a long time, it was kind of as animals as things rather than as actors. So kind of the early animal geographies were sort of an ordering of animals as part of processes and places, as opposed to kind of thinking about the ways that animals act and co-produce space. So critical animal geography is more concerned, emerged in the last kind of 30 years. It's more concerned with human exceptionalism and contesting the human-animal border and the exclusions and inclusions of who matters and who gets to kind of shape spaces. And vegan geographies goes even further than this and is kind of politically and ethically motivated to expose sites of violence, as well as understanding veganism as a spatial practice. And a lot of my PhD was really interested in understanding veganism in the past and in the present as a spatial practice and the kind of spaces of veganism and how they're constituted. And kind of the last part of that vegan geographies, which I was doing in the latter part of my PhD, was thinking about how we might reimagine space after veganism. So how we might reimagine human-animal relationships if or when we become a kind of a vegan world. So yeah, the kind of vegan geographies is anti-hierarchical. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a brief intro to the kind of animal vegan geographies and just a run quickly through what my PhD is going to
Thanks. That's a good kind of overall background, because vegan geographies is like a new concept to me, really, as is kind of animal geographies. It's interesting, you said something towards the end there about how vegan geographies are anti-hierarchical. Mm-hmm. Could you expand a little more on that?
Yeah, so I guess one of the, so kind of where critical animal geographies takes exceptions and kind of deconstruct the human-animal border, vegan geographies is more kind of aligning with kind of veganism more generally and taking an anti-speciesist, anti-hierarchical way of looking at space and thinking about space. And so intersecting that with other kinds of like anti-sexist, anti-racist work, these kind of thinking across different imaginings and oppressions in space and of space, mm-hmm. in kind of, so rather than where critical animal geography or animal geography might maintain the kind of human over the animal, a vegan geography is really concerned with kind of deconstructing that and thinking, well, actually, we're not above animals, but rather how are we all kind of co-constituting this space? How are we all connected together? And actually, how can we do our research, do our work, and think in order to deconstruct that hierarchy and actually research for animals or with animals rather than just on animals?
Okay, yeah. So it's kind of like working against that human exceptionalism, mm-hmm. and seeing humans as a part of the picture and not kind of the agents, with the animals just being things that happen in the background.
Absolutely, yeah. It's kind of, it's not just, we're not just acting on them, they're not just acting on us, but actually we're all acting on one another in these kind of networks or assemblages of different species, different mm-hmm. beings, different individuals. So not just at the species level, but the individual level in mm-hmm. particular ways. And those ways are spatially diverse. So in different places, there's different ways that these things are going on, from like the hyperlocal level of the home to kind of broader, like institutionalized farming. So it is working across all of these kind of levels to rethink actually what is that human animal, or even beyond human animal, because it's like human animal space, this kind of multi-species relationship. What does that look like? And how might we kind of advocate for a different way of doing that?
Okay. And picking up on the history part of it, was Richard Rider the person who coined the word speciesism?
Yeah, he was. So so he coined speciesism, and then, so it was 1970, I think. So this was, I was in Richard Rider's archive, which is homed at the Department for Politics and Public Life at the British Library. And so I was there in 2016-17 as part of their like PhD placement scheme. And so Richard Rider, in his archive, has the kind of speciesism original leaflet. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
I don't think I have, no.
Oh, so it's the original leaflet. Well, the story Rider tells, and this story is also told in Singer's Animal Liberation, is that Richard Rider was in the bath and he has like this eureka moment. He's like, animal rights is just like women's rights or anti-racist rights. You know, speciesism, what sounds like sexism, racism, is speciesism. So this is how Rider tells the story. And I mean, we can definitely contest that, because these kind of conversations link in thinking about animal, the treatment of animals as linked in those ways, had been going on for years before by like feminist thinkers like Carol Adams published the ideas before this.
Right.
So, you know, these conversations had already been going on. But Rider tells it this way anyway. He tells it as he had this eureka moment and he came up with the idea of speciesism, despite the fact there were all these kind of parallel histories going on that he certainly would have known about. In the 1970s, so he, before this, he'd gone to America to do his master's or PhD in psychology. And basically when he was there, one of the things, I can't remember what kind of psychology it was, but they had to like do experiments on monkeys. And he was like, no, I can't do this. Came back to to England and ended up in Oxford in the 1970s. And this is where he met people like Rosalind Anne Stan Godlevich and Peter Singer eventually. This is where they actually met. And he became really involved in animal welfare, animal rights activism. And so in 1970, when he came up with this, or 1971, the year's escaping me, when he came up with the term speciesism, he basically produced these leaflets in that he circulated around Oxford. And it was an image of a monkey who'd been, or a chimpanzee, who'd been infected with syphilis. And so this, there is an image of it somewhere on, he's published it online somewhere. I think it's called, I think where it's published is, if you Google speciesism again, you'd be able to see the original leaflet. Right. And so there's this image of this chimpanzee absolutely covered in like syphilis sores. And alongside this, he writes his kind of connecting species with race and sex, and saying, you know, if these are the logics, that we wouldn't discriminate on race or sex or any other of these characteristics, then this extends to species. And so this was the beginning of his kind of animal rights activism in Oxford. And so he worked with the Oxford group, and eventually there's several publications from the group. And then they were kind of, this is where he met Singer, this is where he met Tom Reagan. So kind of the power of this group in defining the kind of animal rights theory that we have today is huge. It's really huge. And I think Robert Garner's publishing, or imminently publishing, or just published a book on the Oxford group.
Right.
So I know he's been researching it for the last few years. So this kind of group was really instrumental in the kind of animal rights theories that we know today, that for the kind of Singers, the Reagans, and their kind of the way they work together, and the fact that they kept in touch for so many years. And there's like 40, 50, well, would that be right? Yeah, 40 years of correspondence in Ryder's archive between this group, this kind of core group of men. And what they basically, the way he talked about it in his papers and documents, was that what they were doing at the time was they were legitimizing the animal rights movement.
Okay.
And so he basically writes that kind of where the animal welfare movement had since the 19th century been dominated by older women, eccentrics, kind of people that, in his words, you wouldn't take very seriously. He saw himself and Singer and the Oxford group as young, respectable activists who were all, you know, upper middle class. They were all wealthy. They were all white. They were all young. And they were all educated. And so he saw that what they were doing as kind of legitimizing this this animal rights movement, that as a kind of rational political activism, you know, this was a rational political goal that made complete sense if you followed the logics of that, these kind of rational logics, as opposed to what he saw before. He saw the kind of earlier animal welfare stuff as really sentimental and attached to kind of women's values, and as such, that was why it never succeeded. And they kind of saw themselves as the new guard. We're going to make animal rights respectable, and this is how we're going to do it. We're going to follow these kind of organizational, these institutional routes to fight for the cause of animals. And so, yeah, I found that quite interesting in his archive, the way that they really thought that this was the way to success. And I think we still see some of those lineages in the way we talk in activism today.
Yeah, that's interesting, because there does seem to be that kind of like a kind of a conflict between the duality within animal rights, between like emotion and like rationality. But a lot of like what's coming through from the mainstream vegan movement is like this focus on logic and truth and objectivity and like moral relevance and stuff. It's kind of like the emotional side is not, although there's a lot of that in the actual messaging and stuff, like, you know, where the messaging is like care for animals and, you know, imagine yourself in their place and that kind of thing. I think the kind of the theory side seems to be more, or at least the presentation of the theory seems to be more about the kind of logic and justice aspect.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, because certainly in the last few years, there's been a real resurgence of this reliance on rights. And this animal rights kind of thought has trickled down from basically Singer's utilitarianism. So it's trickled down like 40, 45 years later. This is still the kind of intellectual activist think work that we're turning to. But actually, a lot's changed in the last 45 years. And should we really... Well, like, should we be still be appealing to this rational logic on one side? And it's as if that has to underpin the kind of emotional work. So that emotional activism is a hook in. It's a hook in, and then the rights will convince you. But this kind of liberal framework of rights, is that necessarily the right way to move forward animal activism? So like, rights doesn't even, you know, it's like, oh, well, it's as if it's human rights, but human rights aren't extended to all humans. They're not extended equally to all humans. So is this over-reliance on rights really kind of the way that we want to continue pursuing animal advocacy or not? And what does that rely on? You know, what kind of underpinning logics do these, does this reliance on rights rely on? And does it, in denying that kind of sentimentality? And so at the same time, in the late 80s, early 90s, some activists would say, you know, I don't even like animals. It's nothing to do with love. It's just the right thing to do. It's logically and rationally the right thing to do. Whereas I think more recently, we've turned away from that and kind of tried to bring in emotion, and we've tried to bring in love, but who's allowed to do that? Still, so there's a paper called Pussy Panic by a group of scholars based, I think, in Australia. And so they talk about this. They're like, well, who's allowed to love animals in their activism? And again, it's basically upper middle class white men and privileged women. And they're like, well, only these people, you know, when these people do it, it kind of troubles it, and therefore it becomes legitimate. Whereas, you know, if we're keeping those kind of dualities and problems in veganism, if we're not challenging those, then really is that the kind of logic that we want that underpins an anti-speciesist, anti-hierarchical kind of ethic? Because to me, that doesn't underpin that ethic. You know, all these things need to be challenged at once. So I think one of the interesting things in the archives for me was seeing some of the same problems then, the same discussions then, the same debates then, are still being had now. And it's like, well, some of those we've resolved and they keep being brought up. And it's like, well, at what point do we keep going back to the same question? Like, at what point do we just say, we're no longer arguing whether or not animals have a right to life? What we're doing is taking this further, and we're going to talk to people that already think that and try, you know, we're no longer arguing whether or not animals are sentient. We already know that. We already believe that. So actually, what kind of conversations are we going to be part of, and what kind of conversations should we steer away from, I think, is a big question. Because if these same debates are coming around 50 years later, actually, we're not going to have an answer, because the answer's, you know, it's the unanswerable question, you know. The problem, but if we keep focusing on this, it's not that people want an answer, they just don't want to, you know, they don't want this conversation to move on, because then it might be that we have to rethink what we're doing, rethink who we're engaging in conversation, and rethink actually what we've been doing this whole time.
Yeah, that, and I suppose that would have consequences for a lot of the nonprofits who've kind of set themselves up to deal with it in that way. So to have this huge rethink that might make, might impact on people's jobs and things might, trouble them that way.
Yeah, and I'm certainly not saying, you know, this is definite, but actually, if we're still caught up on these same conversations, and we're still caught up on trying to argue that animals have a right to life, which we'll always have to argue, because people aren't just going to agree, are they? But actually, only arguing that, only having those conversations, that's still being the main, the main like debates I see on Twitter and Instagram. Actually, we need to find ways to divert that conversation to talk about other things as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And is there, I mean, from what I know about Richard Ryder, Tom Reagan, and Peter Singer, is that actually all of their theories fall down a little bit. I'm not so sure I know much about Ryder, but with Singer being a utilitarianist and Tom Reagan, I think he said that rights only apply to actually mammals over the age of 1 year old.
So I think what Ryder does is try to pose a third way, basically. So he was definitely the lesser known of the three. So he's published several books, and what he tries to pose is painism, which tries to take the kind of I'm air quoting, best bits of Reagan and Singer, and find a way that is kind of, it still relies on this utilitarian adding of adding and subtracting of variables, but it adds and subtracts pain, and he takes from Reagan what do we constitute as pain. And so, yeah, I think the problem with these like kind of theories is, if you're going to approach these in this kind of, you know, we wouldn't extend them to human others. We wouldn't extend a utilitarian way of thinking about suffering to human others. So actually, what do we need this totalizing theory where we can think about every variable and add and subtract all the kind of like degrees of pain, degrees of sentience to bring them to a less bad level? Or do we actually need to be thinking about wholly new theories altogether, you know, and learning from those theories, but at the same time still thinking, and, you know, I like to think in this kind of reimagining way, and to fall back on a rights perspective isn't really reimagining anything. It's just kind of reproducing the same frameworks that we already see failing. So what other ways of thinking are there? I guess is kind of what I try and think about.
Can you expand some more on, you said that you had interviews with vegans about like what that was about and some of the outcomes from those conversations?
Yeah, so I interviewed vegans mostly in 2018, and I spoke to them about lots of different things. I spoke to them partially about what they knew about the histories of veganism. I spoke to them about where they thought veganism was going. So I was really interested in the kind of temporalities of veganism, like what are the relationships to the past and what are the relationships to the future. But I think one of the most interesting things I was thinking about was questions of the body and embodied knowledges. And so I've been working on this, working on writing this up over the past couple of months, and thinking about kind of how the body and embodied knowledge was really quite powerful in the narratives of all of the vegans, or almost all of the vegans, not all of them, but almost all of the vegans I spoke to. And not only this embodiment, so the embodiment that they talked about was, so when I was listening, I was transcribing the interviews, I noticed over and over again people like, and that's how I found the truth, and I felt the truth deep in my body, and I had this bodily reaction, and for some people that was crying, for some people that was anger, for some people that was being sick, and they were like these real powerful embodied kind of reactions to finding out about animal slaughter, animal cruelty, the kind of things that humans do to animals for not only meat but for dairy and eggs. And so this truth became kind of entangled with this embodied reaction, and the entanglement of this truth or learning about these, like witnessing or finding out about animal cruelty and animal slaughter, and at the same time having this embodied reaction kind of entangled in the narratives. And so it's kind of repeated, and I think this solidified for a lot of the vegans, having this embodied reaction to it solidified the rightness or the goodness, I'm kind of air quoting these as well, of what they were doing. And so this kind of moved them to connect through their body with other bodies. And I mean, really, like not just reducing them to a body, but really it was like an embodied feeling. It was in their gut or in their heart or in their brain. Kind of, and for lots of people that then was like, oh, I could feel in my body what that cow must have felt. I could feel in my body, you know, I can feel pain. And that sharing of pain was really important to these kind of conversions to veganism. I guess this is what we might call a visceral politics or an embodied politics. And so this kind of became a kind of like, when we eat, what we eat, the kind of reconstructing this as a, what the philosopher Anne-Marie Mould, like when we eat not only what we're eating, but the whole process of this, the whole process of eating. So if there's violence in the way that things or beings become food, we're eating this violence. And so we become violent. And so this kind of all connected in very much in the body. and through different kinds of bodies. So this was kind of this really interesting thing was going on between these encounters with truth and these things going on in the body that really solidified that. And so then say, well, I'd say, oh, do you think, have you ever had doubts about your veganism? Have you ever thought, you know, I don't want to be vegan anymore? And like everyone I spoke to was like, I've thought, you know, this is hard because there's like geographical problems, like problems in the family, problems in relationships, problems in like navigating the world as a vegan. It's not always easy. There's not always available food, more so these days, but there hasn't always been like available food. But they always came back to, but I knew in my body it was wrong. And so I knew that when you know, I felt this in my body, I'm not going to go against what my body's telling me. And this is interesting because it entangles with this kind of good feeling and moves veganism beyond, like, so when we normally think about veganism and the body, we think about it in this kind of health is as a healthism. So feeling good is this kind of, you know, I feel great, I've been vegan, and I feel great, my health's got so much better. And this kind of selling of veganism as a health good. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have the kind of trident of activism, animals, environment, and health. Mm-hmm. But that last health one is quite an individualist approach to veganism. So, oh, go vegan for your health is really, so when you take that in isolation, it presents it as, oh, your veganism is for the self. And if that stops working for the self, then you should stop doing that. If that stops being like, if your health doesn't improve, you should stop being a vegan and do something else. But actually, that's really not the kind of, you know, that's not really what we want to be saying about veganism. And so, yeah, it's mostly packaged as entangled with environmental and animal concerns. But actually, when thinking about this good feeling in the body coming from veganism, I like to think of it in this this other way, this kind of, so my bad feeling was produced from seeing what I was complicit in. And so good feeling can be a kind of ungoverning of the body. And it doesn't have to be this healthiest thing, but it's this kind of good feeling as in, I feel what I'm doing is right. And this comes with its own set of problems, but it kind of helps to move beyond the kind of good feeling body. You know, it's not just about health, but your body should feel good for other reasons, for like ethical and political reasons.
That's interesting. Because you'll often see vegans saying, like, veganism should be about the animals only, but like the bonus side of it is that your health will improve as well. Mm-hmm. And obviously the environment will benefit. When we go back to what we were talking earlier about rights and the kind of rationality, which was almost like an abstraction, it's like a disembodied view of what's right, and then comparing it to that right feeling within the body. Mm-hmm. And also when you think about veganism, kind of what it's one of the intentions, or maybe you could say the main intention is actually like it's a boycott. You know, you're refusing to take other animals' bodies. And if people do that after going vegan, like say they slip up and they eat a bit of cheese or whatever, and then they have that bad feeling or it makes them feel sick and so on. That's really interesting to think of it that way. And how the kind of that thing about ungoverning, about how veganism was initially like a resistance against all the food we've been, you know, animals are being, we're being told animals are food and we should eat them. So that also plays into it, that whole kind of resistance against the norms and the culture, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely. I think this is probably my kind of geography perspective. So it thinks of the body itself as a space in which the kind of interior of the body is implicated in what's going on outside. So if you think of, and all of these things came up in the interview. So I remember someone saying, oh, I see it as a boycott. I choose not to put that in my body, and therefore I'm not implicated in this whole chain of events beforehand. I'm seeing the boycott as part of this activism. Boycotting of other bodies in their own body. And so it kind of, I think it's the veggies campaign back here, or I'm not going to remember the date now, but it's like, what's wrong with McDonald's? Do you know the campaign?
It's quite an old one, actually, right? Okay.
It's quite an old one, but it was basically they took McDonald's to It was McLibel they took. So the original, their kind of leaflet, what's wrong with McDonald's, in this leaflet, they said, liberation begins in the stomach. I hope I'm quoting this right. Otherwise, I'm really embarrassed. But the kind of idea that liberation begins in the stomach, it begins in the inside the body, is a really interesting one in thinking about how this interior space that is really, so I mentioned Anne-Marie Moll before, but she talks about how the inside of your body you can't control. You know, there's all these processes, metabolizing, biological processes going on within you that you can't control, but you can control what or who you're being kind of fueled by. And I think this is really interesting in relation to these kind of embodied geographies or thinking about veganism as embodied, is you can, vegans are making this choice in what fuels them. So or who doesn't fuel them? They don't eat animals, therefore this is kind of a different way of being in the world and being entangled with the world. So the kind of how they negotiate space and how isn't fueled by those other bodies that they've kind of boycotted, which is what you were talking about, this kind of boycott. So I think it's a really interesting kind of actually, how do we move from these really big theories of rights that we can say, oh, here's what a right is, here's what rights who should get, which I think it's important for us to think through. And I think lots of that work going on at the moment is really interesting, but also how is this a lived experience? How are people talking about this? Why they're doing it? And how is this changing people's lives and spaces? And it was quite surprising to me to see so many people talking about it in this very like visceral embodied way to thinking about the kind of the bodily reactions to veganism. So I really expected everyone to be like, not everyone, but I expected a lot more of, oh, and this is the kind of, I read all the stuff and then I became vegan. But actually for almost everyone I spoke to, they were like, I became vegan and then I read all the stuff. Yeah. Like I found out what I found out and I was disgusted, I was horrified. And then over the next few months and years, then I educated myself. And so the kind of logics or the theory underpinning it was secondary to their own embodied knowledge. And so they trust that body more than they trust the kind of theory. And now I guess the question is, well, how do we kind of create the conditions to have those moments, those like intersubjective moments of connection? That's the question. And I did wonder perhaps when I was writing up, so lots of people talked about how it was in either through watching films or through or how they thought that, you know, like the cube of truth and things were effective. But then so they all thought these were effective ways of them doing activism. But then when I asked, you know, no one I interviewed, was that the reason that they weren't vegan? So it's kind of interesting perspectives. And actually a lot, probably over half of the people that I interviewed went vegan because they knew vegans.
Yes.
So they learned from other vegans about all of these things. So now we're trying to like curate these spaces in which to create the conditions for caring, but they're not the ways we came to veganism. So what is the kind of, what's the power of the kind of drip, drip, drip effects? Like, oh, a little video here, a bit of street activism there, a conversation here, a conversation there. But how do you, I mean, you can't quantify that. You can't create those ongoing conditions. So it becomes something much more of, well, what do I need to do is I need to live and kind of share that life, is kind of the conclusion that most of the people I spoke to were, so that there are spaces for activism, but also what I need to do is live and kind of connect and speak to people as well as doing that activism. So it's quite interesting in really these like complicated ways that vegans are thinking about how to navigate the world as vegans and as representatives. And it's a lot of pressure, you know, like people are like, oh, I don't want to do the wrong thing and I don't want to become that stereotype of an angry vegan, or I don't want to be like crying in the supermarket. And so it's a kind of also a process of kind of becoming not immune to the world, but I'm sure you remember when you first went vegan, everywhere you see violence, everywhere walking around the supermarket, like this is you know, this is overwhelming. And then over the years you just kind of not get used to it, because I don't know, sometimes it breaks through and you're like, oh god, is this really happening? But you sort of learn how to re-navigate space or re-navigate the world as a vegan. And so because I spoke to so many people at different, like some people have been vegan for like 6 months and some have been vegan for like 20 years. And it was really interesting to kind of contrast against or across different stories of like, oh, I recognize that bit from when I was just like angry all the time. Yeah. I'm like, oh yeah, you know. So what, you know, it was really interesting to talk to all these different people.
Yeah, the different stages of veganism. That is true, because, you know, when you speak to people, you can recognize, like I speak to people now who maybe are just starting out in activism, and they're using the kind of rhetoric that I would have used and came across when I first got into it as well. And they've not even discovered maybe like anti-speciesism or anti-oppression yet, or why linking with other movements is important and that kind of thing. They're so busy focusing on like, how would you, you know, tell someone the truth in the street and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and this kind of hooked on the truth. And I think it's not made easier by the kind of the need to put things in sound bites almost.
That kind of brings us on to the next point, which was we were going to look at authenticity. And I suppose there's something to do then with what it sounds like is that most vegans are actually trying to live their values and will share those values with other people, friends and family mostly, it seems. And that's how they will bring about change in the world. So I guess that's where we get into the whole kind of purity problem, because we're always thinking and kind of commenting to each other, well, what is a good vegan? Would a vegan do this? And then a lot of people quote kind of the vegan society definition, which says, you know, as far as practical and possible. And everyone has kind of a different, they've kind of set the bar at a different place for themselves, which I think is okay. But then there's obviously some people within the movement who kind of like try and gatekeep and say, no, a vegan is this. So where do you think kind of that like personal authenticity comes into it?
Yeah, I think authenticity is really interesting in the vegan movement. And I think this kind of policing of the boundaries of what is or is not vegan is really, I mean, it's interesting, but it's also a problem, right? So this kind of, and thinking about authenticity in the vegan movement, I think about it as a kind of performance, but not a performance in the kind of way it's used on social media, you know, performance factor, but performative in the kind of Judith Butler sense, which is the performative is a real performance of identity of who you are. So this performance of authenticity isn't to prove a point necessarily, but it is to prove the performance of authenticity is a real representation of how vegans are trying to portray their veganism to the world. So this authenticity, I don't know, competition is very easy to see it as a policing of the boundaries. But it also can be seen as this kind of identity marker, you know, this expression of identity. And I think this is also problematic. And I guess thinking about social media and social media influencer activists, those kind of people that are really, what I was just briefly said then, they kind of provide that soundbite activism. They provide 240 characters and Instagram caption are really diluting the kind of understanding or the authenticity. You know, they're presenting this kind of authenticity that is often really closely connected to again presenting veganism as a good not only for animals and the environment, very often for the kind of for health, for this healthy plant-based diet. Look at me performing veganism or presenting veganism on my channel. You too could look like me, a desirable person, if you were vegan, which actually capitalizes on this kind of veganism's perceived healthfulness and kind of capitalizes or exploits kind of thin, the desire for thin privilege or in thin privilege in societies. So it kind of presents veganism as this kind of purity, this virtue, this lightness, whereas eating animals is this kind of wrongness. It's heavy. It's kind of, it'll make you not desirable, which really plays into a lot of problematic things to do with sizeism, to do with race, to do with health, to do with, you know, health problems. And so that's the kind of representation that we're used to seeing, this kind of overexposed to influencer activists who produce, and I think what they're doing is they're kind of trying to accumulate, you know, social, cultural, and financial capital. So lots of these people pay to do this, right? Yeah. But then in speaking to vegans, there's much less of that. So in interviewing vegans, there's much less of this kind of presentation of the perfect self, and actually much more kind of questioning. Like, I remember one person I spoke to was like, I do feel better. I do feel better. But I don't know if I feel better because this is healthier or if I just feel better because I feel less guilty. And so he was basically saying he'd found out kind of the truth of veganism, but not become vegan for a while, and became quite miserable, and then went vegan. He's like, well, I do feel better, but I don't know, like, you know, I can't say that I am healthier. It's a kind of, it's not a health thing. It's a kind of other thing. But this kind of healthism is kind of a totalizing norm in veganism that produces these binaries of goodness and badness, lightness and heaviness that are just illogical. Because your veganism isn't going to be represented in this perfect body. It's going to be, you know, you're probably not going to change how you look that much just because you go vegan. But that kind of centering of thin white bodies in veganism, that's who gets famous, that's who gets rich, that's who's adored by the media, and it's who people want to follow because of wider societal problems. You know, it's not, we're not isolated, we're not in a vacuum. And so these performances of authenticity, certainly on social media, really contrast with the kind of things that that people, when I was interviewing people, really said about their own kind of experiences of veganism, actually saying, I don't know if I don't know if I feel better. I do feel better, but it's unrelated to this kind of healthism. And there's other ways to think about authenticity in this, and also accountability. So these, when I was thinking about authenticity, it's really hand in hand with accountability. And so activists are trying to present this, or vegans, even not even necessarily activists, are trying to present an authentic veganism that represents both the good parts of veganism, so that it is, you know, the right decision for animals and for the environment and for themselves. But also, it's not always easy. So the lots of the people I spoke to are like, well, you know, it's not easy, and I don't want to tell people it's easy because it's not. And you see that on social media. It's so easy to go vegan, just stop eating it, you know, just stop eating it, which isn't the case. So the people that I was speaking to who prioritize these kind of careful or caring conversations about veganism, like, well, it's not that easy. And so part of it is I'm trying to be authentic, trying to think about what a vegan authenticity looks like. I'm trying to hold myself accountable to animals. I'm trying to hold my past self accountable and tell these truths by saying, oh, yeah, I do miss eating animals. I do miss this particular thing. Do you miss, like, you know, because people always ask you, do you miss stuff? And so vegans are saying, like, well, yeah, I do, but there's all these reasons that I don't eat it or eat that particular product. And so this authenticity is trying to be presented as a kind of holistic representation of veganism as difficult, but ultimately the right thing to do for these individuals. And so this can be in spaces, you know, in vegans going to restaurants that aren't vegan to show their families that you can eat vegan in a normal restaurant. And so one couple that I interviewed would basically say, well, we always go along to the family meal for birthdays and stuff, even if the only thing we can eat is a plate of chips, because we don't want to not go and then everyone be like, oh, they're so miserable, like, I'll never go vegan because look how miserable it is, you can't even come to you, like, your sister's birthday party. So this authenticity is really challenged a lot. And then you say, oh, I miss that. You're like, oh, well, if you miss it, you aren't that pure vegan. If you've asked me if I miss something, so I've said, yeah, I miss it, but I don't eat it for this reason, then, you know, that's undermined anyway. So I guess these questions of how this authenticity is kind of challenged in all sorts of different ways, in all sorts of different scenarios and spaces, and how this is always in, as veganism has become more visible, and the rise of kind of, you know, semi-famous or famous influencer slash activist type people, is it's always in your veganism is always being performed, and your authenticity is always being performed in relation to these kind of other knowledges people have, or these other preconceptions even people have about veganism. And some of those come from way back, come from like, you know, animal rights activists, or like the Animal Liberation Front is something, that's the image people often have in their head of animal rights. And then people in their head might also have this image of like the Gwyneth Paltrow veganism, the kind of thin white rich woman just, you know, eating moon rocks or whatever she does. So you kind of, people are always trying to perform their authenticity without undermining themselves, but also in relation to all these other preconceptions. This is really like navigating the world as a vegan is like really, really, there's a lot going on, you know, there's a lot going on. And so understanding how people are differently negotiating all these kind of considerations in their head with every decision they make was really interesting. I mean, it was really like, wow, that's like, you know, everyone is making a lot of choices. And you do, I guess, because I've been vegan for what, like 7 years now? So you get used to it and you just make those decisions. But then when someone comes questioning you and it's like interviewing you, saying like, oh, why? No, how do you do this? You know, you're then like, oh, well, then I sat back and was like, well, how am I making the kind of decisions I'm making? Where am I going? You know, what is authentic about my veganism, you know, sitting under and kind of questioning myself, which is a really interesting kind of conversation about what we're doing. And these kind of really complex kind of, but I guess they don't feel complex because you just do it, right? In a way, I don't, so you know, you get used to it. So maybe in some way when these activists say, oh, you just do it, I guess if you're not like critically thinking about what you're doing, you do just do it. In a sense, but that just doing it is a kind of repetition of habit or a repetition of performance. That if you sit down and kind of critically think about it, you are actually making these micro decisions almost constantly.
Yeah, it's like there's like a difference between the reality of living veganism and the image of veganism presented by those social media influencers, because the reality is complex and you've got to navigate, like you say, through all these different layers and levels with friends, family, and, you know, the world at large. And then you've got the social media influencers making it out like it's the simplest thing like it could ever be. You just decide one day and you know what the right thing to do is and you just do it. And they'll give you like the stock phrases for answering questions like, why shouldn't you eat honey, and why are backyard eggs not okay, and stuff like that, so that you feel initially that, oh, I've got the tools to kind of respond to those questions. But like you've been saying, is the kind of questions that we get and the kind of social situations we have to face are also varied, that there isn't this kind of like standardized response that these influencers are actually profiting from, because you've got vegans who are looking up to them and going, wow, if only I could be as, you know, sure of myself in my veganism as them. And they play off that image of being like fully pure, and they're living that activist lifestyle and they're going around the world telling everybody about it and stuff. So I feel like it can be actually, the point of an activist is to empower your community, and they're doing the opposite by disempowering people, by making them feel they're not good enough for even daring to ask those questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I think this is one of the kind of other interesting things, is when one of the other things I asked people was, how do you define veganism and how do you define activism? And everyone I spoke to, and some of the people I spoke to had been protesting, organizing, you know, doing real, they'd been doing stuff for years, and some people had just tried to do it in their personal life. They're like, oh, you know, I'm just a personal person, I wouldn't go out and like meet new people anyway, so I just share stuff on social media. But every single one of them said, oh, but I'm not an activist. And I think, well, why don't you think you're an activist? Like, oh, because, you know, if you're an activist, you dedicate your whole life to it. And this again comes back to this kind of construction of who gets to be an activist. And it's this kind of construction of people who can be completely untethered from reality, who don't have other responsibilities. So it's a very gendered construction. And it's also who can be an activist, well, who can navigate space easily, who can navigate the world easily. And for animal rights activists, that's a kind of product of whiteness as well. So this is a kind of a gendered and raced construction of who gets to be an activist, which then becomes really problematic because, as you're saying, the whole constituency of vegans are like, oh, no, I don't do anything. You know, I just do veganism, do a bit of this, a bit of that, and that's it. I'm not an activist. But really, they are the activists. They're the whole constituency of activists who are doing stuff. But they're also the people that are following, or, you know, they're following. They're the people that these influencer activists, people rely on. They rely on these kind of, on kind of keeping them not thinking they're activists.
Yes.
They rely on kind of, like you said, disempowering them, exactly, in order for them to continue accumulating that kind of cultural, social and financial capital, because these people make a living off their kind of activism. And they, it's as if, and through the ways that they kind of represent themselves on social media, it becomes as if they are part of the constituency, when actually over the last few months we've had all sorts of stories of these kind of famous activists just turn up at various events just for a photo op and then leave.
So
it's like, well, you're not part of the constituency that you claim to be representing. And what you're saying is, oh, you too can do this, just do it. But what you're doing is you're denying that you have any privilege in even navigating the world. Like, some people just cannot navigate the world that easily. Some people are less safe at demonstrations from policing. And so this kind of representation of, oh, you know, well, I'm not an activist is really quite, is hard to hear, because you're like, well, you are an activist. Like, you've just told me like 20 things you've done in the last year. But this kind of relation between who gets to count as an activist and who's just a follower even is really quite a damaging one. It's very disempowering for the wider collective movement.
Give some details about the, you'd mentioned that part of your studies is going to be involving chickens living with people.
Yeah, so the last part of my PhD was on, so this is all connected, the last part of my PhD was basically, it was basically when I left the British Library in 2017, this coincided with my mum rescuing some, or rehoming some ex-laying hens. So they came to live at my parents' house, which is up north, like semi-rural area. And so I spent, well, 2 years, these chickens have all sadly passed away now, but I spent two last years of my PhD, basically going and spending a lot of time with these chickens and trying to get to know these chickens and trying to think about actually what do, so my mum's been vegetarian for like 30 years and she went vegan a couple, like about 6 months after getting the chicken, she went vegan, weirdly, so she started this relationship with the chickens, like, I can't eat their eggs, you know, I'm not eating them anymore, I'm going vegan. So what I was trying to think about was actually how might there be other spaces for different kinds of relationships with farmed animals? Because this is one of the things that we have in veganism. We know exactly what not to do. Mm-hmm. And there's less kind of theorization of what should we do then? So Lips kind of lived part-time with these chickens for a couple of years, built up quite like close relationships with some of them, and thought about like kind of the human chicken interactions, the chickens extraneous to the human, so what happens to the chickens when I'm not there, I don't know, they have all sorts of other relationships with cats, with birds of prey, and just with like pigeons. They have other relationships with worms and beetles and like mites that are on them, and they have all these relationships of kind of predator, prey, they prey on the kind of worms, they are preyed on, and all these kind of like multi-species entanglements of different things going on with these chickens. And so this chicken project, I think, led to me getting my current current position. And so what I'm thinking about at the moment, delayed by COVID, so hopefully I'll be going out into the field at some point in 2021. And basically the project I'm working on now is part of a wider project thinking about urban ecologies and urban animals. And so my research within this is focused on chickens in London. So I'm particularly interested in rehomed chickens in London. So the kind of, there's been a real rise of urban hen keeping over the last 10 years or so. And even, and especially in London, there's been a bit like 5% of all rehomed chickens are rehomed in London.
Right.
And so I'm really interested in understanding what are the kind of imaginaries between, behind people rehoming chicken. Why are they rehoming chickens? What kind of spaces are they cultivating for chickens in the city? What kind of like vision do they have for them living with chickens as a kind of return to nature? And how do we rethink the city if we kind of think about it from a chicken's perspective? So what I'll be doing eventually when things kind of ease up with COVID is I'll be kind of tracing the flows into the city of chickens. So trying to understand, well, there'll be all manner of things I'm sure I'm doing. I'll be doing, but I'm trying to understand where these chickens are coming from. And then they go through these kind of rehomers and come into London. And who's rehoming these chickens? Why are they rehoming these chickens? Why are they rehoming them in London? And why are they kind of, what kind of lives are they creating with these chickens? Like, are they rehoming these chickens for eggs, just for eggs? Are they rehoming these chickens because they kind of have this kind of vision of living with like a kind of urban barnyard imaginary? So can't leave the city because, you know, for whatever reason, can't leave the city. So how do we bring nature into the city or bring animals into the city and rethink the city in this way? And so, yeah, that's what I'm trying to understand is why are people rehoming these hens? And what are the kind of regulations on these hens in the city? You know, who's allowed to rehome hens? How many hens are you allowed to have? What kind of disease controls in place for these hens? And so DEFRA has, you're allowed to like have a flock of 50 chickens basically without any overseeing from DEFRA or from anyone. But there are then all these like laws and regulations about what you can feed the chickens, where the chickens can be, how much space the chickens need to have. You know, you can't have a rooster if you live in particular areas. And so it's a kind of question of, it's all entangled with the kind of wider crises going on. The questions are kind of, are people rehoming chickens in the face of kind of food crisis? And there's kind of evidence lended to this theory because during lockdown, so like the various hen welfare, hen rehoming sites sold out, I'm doing that in air quotes because they weren't selling them. They sold out of chickens to rehome. So at the beginning of lockdown, everyone rehomed a chicken, not everyone, you know, all of the chicken. And normally this doesn't happen and demand for chickens shot up. And now this was potentially related to the fact that what we were seeing in the supermarkets was a running out of food. They weren't running out of food. People were just panic buying food. And then, you know, food became harder to access. Mm-hmm. And so looking into the future, there are going to be continued shocks to our food system and our food supplies, especially because we don't actually grow that much food in the UK. Mm-hmm. So actually, are people rehoming these chickens as a kind of reaction to this food crisis just for eggs? And places like British Hen Welfare Trust and Fresh Start for Hens specifically say, you know, these are older chickens, they might not produce eggs. So you can't, like, don't rehome them just for eggs. We really ask that you kind of take them in for their retirement, so to speak. So then if this is kind of, if people are paying attention to this, is this then, whether they are or not, is this then something to do with a kind of reclaiming of nature and in the face of kind of environmental crises, are people trying to curate or create green spaces or spaces of nature and kind of like putting together animals in nature? And they're like, oh, well, like, this is a kind of return to nature in the city and we're kind of green in the city. And what are the kind of limits of instrumentalizing chickens in that way? Because that's quite an instrumental way to think of like, oh, I need to make the city more inhabitable for me, therefore I'm going to bring these chickens into it.
Yeah.
Or then is there some other kind of ethical question going on? You know, well, I don't want to, you know, is I'm going to rehome these chickens because I think that's the right thing to do. And I think all of these will be at play. Also, is there some question of, well, there's a kind of housing crisis, so I can't necessarily leave London, so I'm going to bring these chickens on and potentially on an allotment or something. So is this a kind of, well, I'm never going to be able to leave London because of you know, my job, I can't afford a house, whatever reason. So I'm going to get some chickens and I'm going to get an allotment, and it's going to be like my own patch of nature in the city. And so what I'm really interested in is actually what are these kind of flows? What are the regulations? And why are people doing this? Why is this, how is this really related to wider problems or wider crises, not just in the UK, but across the globe, but really centered in London? So I'm very excited to start doing this. And this kind of, I guess, was influenced by my earlier work with chickens, but that was in a kind of rural area, so it's very different. But then thinking about it, it's like, well, I would never be able to rehome chickens myself because I'm stuck renting. Now I can't buy a house. So one of the problems with this kind of project, or not problems, but one of the things I'm thinking about in this project is, well, who actually has the space to rehome chickens in London? Because this is going to be a class issue, you know. You're not going to be able to rehome chickens unless you essentially own your own property with a garden in London. And so who's going to be able to afford their own property in London with a garden? And so what I'm also looking at is other kinds of spaces, like forest schools, like community allotments, and trying to think of, like, actually, are there other places? So I've not started yet, so I can't tell you the answer. But are there other places that are more of a collective kind of endeavor, that aren't just, this isn't just a middle class pursuit? Because I don't think it is just a middle class pursuit. But, and if it is a middle class pursuit, I think that's because of constraints. You know, it's not because only they want to do it. It's because, well, if we're all stuck, you know, if we're renting, we can't have a cat, we can't have a dog, we can't have chickens in the garden because we don't own land. We don't own this property. And then it becomes a whole entangled with, like, well, you know, who has the right to the city? Who are these chickens getting to live with, and who are these chickens not getting to live with? And how is that really unequal, unequal right to the city really exemplified in who gets to live with animals, who gets to care for animals, who gets to reshape the city with animals? Because it's always going to be a very particular kind of person who does that. So that's kind of what I'm thinking about in the kind of rehoming thing, but from the kind of vegan perspective on kind of, so that's the kind of wider project. What I'm personally interested in as well is, so what I had when we started living with the chickens, I really wanted to be the chickens' friend. I really wanted them to, like, do you see on Facebook these people have chickens, the chickens sit on their knee and the chickens love them. Exactly. And I just wanted that relationship. I was like, yeah, I want these chickens to love me. And then I met the chickens. They were like, yeah, I'm not interested. You know, they were both really scared and really nervous. They'd never seen me outside before. They'd never been outside of a barn before. They were born in this, like, incubator, moved into a barn and fattened up to be sent to the, like, laying farm. They'd never seen the outside before. They were really nervous, really scared. And then here comes me. I'm like, oh, I've been my friend. And then I realised, like, over the weeks after, like, that was, like, not a good way for me to approach this relationship. And so, like, critically reflecting on, like, well, why do you want the chickens to be your friend? It's not, you can't just force that on someone. You have to kind of build this trust. And this was immediately, like, shown to me when they were like, I'm not interested. Just leave me alone. And so actually, then I'm thinking, like, you know, that was, not that I didn't hurt them or anything, but it was just, like, my own, like, unlearning of those relationships that we're taught to have with animals. And there was still some, like, unlearning for me to do there. And so what I'm interested in is actually, like, if people are rehoming chickens, you know, in these spaces because they want eggs, or if they want a relationship, or they want, what do they want? And how is that kind of, how is the labor or the work that the chickens are being asked to do not necessarily different? Like, it's obviously different in intensity, but is it not the same kind of labor that's being asked to be done by intensively farmed chickens? You know, if you were rehoming chickens and we're rehoming them because we want eggs, then that's still the same kind of labor. It's just a different intensity. You know, it's still, it's not unthinking those relationships. So it's like, well, what can I learn? You know, what is there to kind of deconstruct and think about here? In these spaces that are definitely, you know, for non-vegans, the backyard hen, like I think you mentioned, the backyard hen is seen as, you know, that I'm not doing anything. It's got a lovely life out there. She's got a lovely life out there.
Yeah, exactly.
I just take the eggs in a process of exchange. I provide a home. They get, you know, I get the eggs. But actually, that's not, you know, that's not an anti-hierarchical, anti-speciesist way of living with chickens. Mm-hmm. It's not unthinking any relationship. It's just the same kind of relationship, but a different intensity. And so maybe that's like, you know, a conceptual level. But if we have to, if we're thinking about anti-speciesist ways, then these are the kind of questions that we need to ask, not only about eating eggs, you know, not only about that, but if like, well, why am I approaching animals in this way? Why do I expect them to want a relationship with me? You know, that is again a kind of form of human exceptionalism. We're like, of course they would, you know, but they didn't have to. They didn't have to be my friend at all. And eventually, like over the years, I became close to some of the chickens. Not all of the chickens. Some of them still were just like, no, I'm not interested. It's an individual and like developing these like individual relationships. But yeah, I think it's an interesting question actually. How are these different, not necessarily different forms of human supremacy or kind of violence, but they're certainly different intensities, but are they necessarily different forms?
It's that thing about, it seems like it's humans feel entitled to, you know, even, and like you're saying, even we as vegans sometimes still do that because we haven't thought through that those relationships, because these are so like deeply ingrained in us that you think that, you know, with our companion animals, that because we're giving them a home and food and shelter and so on, that they should then reward us with love. But, you know, even in your human friendships and relationships, it doesn't work like that. You know, you don't, I suppose in some ways, like family relationships can be like hierarchical, you know, the family unit and so on. But I suppose with friendship, there's this kind of attempt to just, you know, let someone be who they are. And that's what's important. But when it comes to non-human animals, we almost never let them be who they are because they've always got a function or a purpose or a, we've decided what the relationship will be.
I think that's interesting you brought up friendship. So one of the things I've not actually mentioned, but a lot of my PhD was kind of theorizing an interspecies friendship. And what you're saying there is a friendship isn't an exchange of goods. It's not an exchange of values. It's not, these are the terms, this is how it works. It's far more complicated than that. And it's kind of has to be engaged in from both sides, or you can have quite a kind of an oppressive friendship and a befriending that's kind of, you know, not reciprocated. And so actually how, you know, it's not just an exchange of different properties that you can add up and this is a friendship, but it really has to be getting to know the individual and learning about the individual and their likes, dislikes, what they want, what their desires, what do they not like? And then that becomes far more complicated. And if you really, like, a friendship isn't a wholly positive thing. Well, you know, it's not always, a friendship isn't just about the good times. It's also about frustration. It's about disagreements. It's about holding accountable other friends. It's about learning about yourself as much as the other friend. So actually, how is this in animal relationships is not, you can't just be the befriender. You can't just impose upon the animal. But you have to allow, you have to really be interested in learning about the individual as well as kind of the species or kind of generally about what's good for a particular species. You also have to learn about the individual, which I think is important as well.
Yeah, totally. That actually kind of reminds me of some conversations I've had recently about sanctuaries. And I've seen some stuff online as well about, you know, what these relationships should be like in sanctuaries, because they can still be, even in animal sanctuaries and with the best intentions, some people who work there or who are involved, maybe because of like financial pressures and so on, that, you know, they've got so many animals that they need to take care of that they can't allow for that individual expression, or they don't have enough volunteers to help out, so they have to, like, say, for example, it was actually Elliot who was on the podcast who was saying this, that they might say, you know, we've got 30 pigs and we'll just have to keep them all over there in that field, and we'll feed them all the same food, we'll, you know, because that's going to make things easier for you as the sanctuary owner. So even in sanctuary spaces, we can still be bringing those kind of relationship dynamics into play.
Yeah, definitely. I listened to that episode the other week, and it's really interesting. It's like, well, of course we want to be able to have these individual relationships, but because for various reasons, and one of those reasons outside of sanctuaries is that lots of us just don't have relationships with animals. Or we don't have kind of those close relationships with animals, like, you know, there's birds in my garden, there's cats that come to visit, there's bugs, but you know, I don't have a companion animal because I can't have a companion animal. So actually some of this is that a lot of humans just don't know how to have relationships with animals because they don't meet animals. And so I grew up in the countryside and I grew up around animals. But if I hadn't, I don't know, you know, if you're in the urban space, if you're in the city, what animals are you seeing to have these kind of relationships with? And I think that's interesting. And then you come into the sanctuary, and obviously sanctuaries are overpressured and they don't want to turn anyone away because the alternative is so bad. They're also limited by funding, by rent, by space. And it's so, well, all of this stuff is kind of entangled in each other. You know, these aren't separate issues. And then you also have this kind of other debate in the sanctuaries as to whether you have open sanctuaries where people can come and visit or closed sanctuaries. And so the open sanctuary, the idea is that people are going to come and visit, pay, and you're going to have more money for the animals. But then the animals are asked, basically, or not even asked, demanded that they kind of are part of these relationships with humans that they might not want to be part of. And certainly some animals love spending time with humans and all different humans, but some animals don't want to, some individuals don't want to. And so then you have the closed sanctuary where you're just like, no, you can't come and just watch the animals or feed the goats or whatever. But then what you run the risk is that, well, if I can't go and see them, I'm not going to give them money because I'm not, you know, well, this is obviously my logic. But if you can't, if you're not getting something back, why should you donate money? But all of this is just entangled in this kind of, the kind of contemporary late capitalist society that we find ourselves in, that none of us can have, or very, very few of us can have a good life. And our lives are also precarious. And they all rely on each other across species as well as within species. But what can, we're all limited by these kind of higher up demands, the demands of capitalism, to keep us not forming those bonds. We're not able to do it. You know, we're really constrained across all areas of our lives in what we can do, in the amount of time we have to do it, whilst also working to pay the rent, but not, you know, not earning enough to ever have that deposit for a mortgage, or being able to live a good life. And I think the last few months have certainly been a time of reflection for a lot of us, or for a lot of us who are privileged enough, you know, to have had the time to think about it, to think about, well, what do we value? What kinds of work do we value, and what kinds of work do we not value? And actually, what is the vision here? Like, at the moment, like, I used to imagine the future, and at the moment, like, the future just doesn't, I can't imagine it. I can't see how we can continue in this way. And it's like, well, it's also like, well, why are we buying into this and choosing this kind of miserable life, you know, in a way? But it's not that we're choosing, it's that we don't have a choice. I don't know, the future, the kind of horizon seems to have come really close in the last few months. So what do these kind of futures look like, where, when it feels like a lot of us are just trying to survive, like the next week and then the next month, is becomes really difficult to think about, well, what kind of reimagination is there? And I mean, there is a future, but what is it? You know,
and how do we, like, collectively get together and find the power to do that?
And how do we talk across these things? You know, I think, like, that's there's no one cause. All of these things are kind of really, like, entangled, and it's hard to kind of, like we've been saying, this kind of very easy to have a soundbite, but actually thinking about that theory, thinking about the vision of the future is much harder. And so it's much easier to be like, oh, I'll just get the old, you know, to promote something saying, oh, just reach for the almond milk instead of the dairy milk. That's much easier than sitting here and, you know, talking like we have and like you do regularly for over an hour with all different people about thinking, what does the future look like? It's far more difficult, and it's far more difficult to engage with. But how do we try and prioritize that is the question.
So we've kind of covered a lot of this actually in what we've been discussing, but I was wanting to hear from you what you think then. We know kind of what the problems are with vegan advocacy, or some of the problems, some of the main problems. What do you think good anti-speciesist advocacy might look like?
So I've been thinking about this, and I think it's really hard. Obviously, it's really hard to say anything. But I think one of the things that's really important is to think not only about anti-speciesist advocacy, but thinking beyond species. So thinking about individuals, thinking about localities, thinking about spaces, thinking about the different kinds of labour animals were asked to engage in, different politics, different relations. And I guess I'd put all of this under different geographies. So actually trying to promote thinking not as a homogenous species, but as kind of different kinds of individuals. And trying to not let go of that when we talk about animals, to kind of prioritize that, but also think about, you know, of course species matters. Species has material consequences. For a chicken, there's consequences, material consequences, them being a chicken, in the ways that their labor and their bodies are exploited. But all of these kind of, like, the labor, the species, the individual, the geography, the kind of animal, the position in the world, the relations, they're all in relation with one another. So I guess a kind of thinking about a good anti-species advocacy is refusing simplicity and embracing kind of nuance and complexity. And so not giving the easy answer when someone says, oh, what do you think of this? Not giving that easy answer is a really important part of anti-speciesist advocacy. And so kind of prioritizing troubling the way that we've kind of come to do things, and to continue kind of critically reflecting on what we have kind of come to see as the easy answer. And I think this is really entangled with thinking beyond species. Well, literally the name of the podcast, Beyond Species. And this idea of the beyond is really interesting. You know, what is in the beyond? You know, what is beyond species for us? And this speculative space, even though I've said, you know, the future kind of feels like it's closing in, the horizon feels like it's kind of coming, this kind of speculative space of the beyond is, I think, occupying that space of the beyond, and, you know, not giving the simple answer is really important to kind of entangling anti-speciesism with a kind of bricolage of ways, techniques, theories, disagreements. Certainly, I don't think we're all going to disagree about everything, but also rejecting white supremacy, rejecting misogyny, rejecting capitalism within our advocacy. And calling that out, you know, calling out those people who are exploiting that. So we basically need to move beyond the individual as well as beyond species and kind of learn across struggles, which I think lots of vegans do anyway. I think lots of vegans do think across struggles anyway. But, you know, I think thinking, well, actually, even if there's a movement that's, or not a movement, but a space that's not vegan, but they're doing something well, how can we engage with that space and have a dialogue rather than being reactionary, kind of moving beyond that, which isn't any clear answer, but kind of refusing simplicity.